Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers, and welcome to this week's Slacker Podcast. It is a podcast with a lead singer from Elbow, the Manchester Merlin that is Guy Garvey, somebody whose music I've enjoyed a lot over the years, and I've just respected him on many different levels. He is the person that, like, I think he is probably, if you put in a top league of people that you want to go for a pint with in the UK, Guy Garvey has to be up at the top. You'd have Guy Garvey up there. You'd have like Tom Hardy up there. Who else would I have up there? Judi Dench. She'd be good crack for a pint, wouldn't she? But yeah, we've got Guy Garvey. We didn't have pints. We had way too much caffeine, actually. I think two teas and a coffee from my memory. And yeah, we sat down in his studio in Brixton just before lockdown. I think this was either the start of March or end of February. And it was the last non-Zoom podcast that I recorded. And yeah, it was really fun. I haven't really touched it much in the edit because, like, he's such a great talker. And, like, we're both broadcasters, so there's plenty to talk about. And yeah, he's just a really, really genuinely interesting dude. I think you're going to really like this one. Anyone who's listened to the show who follows me on Instagram or Twitter at Philly Taggart, I'm going to be doing like a live DJ set called The Melancholy Social, and it's going to be at 9 p.m. every single Wednesday. So if you follow me on any platform at all at Philly Taggart, I will post about it and you can watch it. It's got sound effects such as... It has wavy dance music, but like kind of chill, very, very chill for a Wednesday. And it's also got sound effects such as...
Don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day.
It also has shoutouts and other sound effects such as... Might have gone a little bit overboard on the sound effects for it. But yeah, but it's just really fun. I did the first one last week and there's about 2,000 people on and it was just shouting names out, playing lethal tunes, playing stupid sound effects. But all basically just about good music and connecting with people in this savagely weird and unsettling time. Also, big up to anybody who is supporting the podcast on Patreon. We've got new Patreons this week. I'm literally logging on to the website as we go. Yeah, big respect to them. AT, Alan Ray, Leanne Alanis, Nazra Ahmed, Sam and Tobias Dwyer, you, my friends, are doing the Lord's work. So I decided I'm going to treat you with a brand new, fresh podcast, and it's only for people who support the podcast on the Patreon. Every week I'm going to do one where I suggest a real good album, a really good track, and talk about some of the news stories that are happening this week or the week before. I've just gone and recorded it. Actually, we talked a lot about Tekashi 6ix9ine being released from jail. What's going on with that? We talked a lot about Bono and why Irish people don't seem to treat Bono with the respect some people think he deserves. What do we deserve? You'll find out on the Patreon podcast. He turned 60 and he's got this incredible playlist up of songs that saved my life. And there's loads of other sort of news stories that we're talking about up there too. So yeah, an extra sort of 20-25 minute podcast that I'll be doing every single week that I'll be posting on Patreon. Big love to anybody who goes to patreon.com/slackerpodcast. Right. Let's get into this week's podcast with Guy Garvey in 3, 2, 1.
This is a bit of a treat. I am in Brixton and I am in the studio of the one and only Guy Garvey. Hello.
Hi, Phil.
How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
This is a nice spot.
It's good, isn't it? I share this room with a lovely man called Hugh. In fact, it's his spot. He sublets it to me, mm-hmm. office hours, Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
And it's where I do my radio program. It's where I write my songs. And I also do co-writing. And I also do soundtrack these days as well.
Man of many talents.
Yeah. All involving me going on.
Who, like, I see like two names written on the whiteboard there, Dermot Kennedy and Sam Fender.
Mm.
Are those two people you've had in, or
no?
Or is this a list of people to kill?
I've never met either of them. Dermot Kennedy is just a really promising singer. Do you know him?
Yeah. I've met him. He's good.
And Sam Fender, I started writing a song and. I realised that it would really suit Sam.
So yeah, yeah.
Those are names of people that I'm firing work off to and saying, if you ever fancy writing together.
I'd love to hear that.
It's just an experiment, really. Yeah. I've done little bits of co-writing with various singer-songwriters. I suppose that and the soundtrack work that I'm doing is exercising the craft that I've learned through being in Elbow all these years. The writing I do with Elbow is very, very collaborative. You mm-hmm. know, we all write those songs together. I'm the only lyricist, but we all write that stuff together. So I know how to collaborate. If you're co-writing a song with somebody else, you can go anywhere character-wise. Elbow stuff tends to be songs about my life, our experiences as a band sometimes, mm-hmm. And often about being in a band, you know, the Weather to Fly and songs like that. Whereas co-writing a song from scratch with somebody, quite often I'm listening to them talk about their lives and helping them put it into song form and using the craft side rather than the soul searching of the blank canvas.
Does that make it a little bit easier when you're walking out of the studio at the end of the day? Because I'd imagine if you're writing some pretty heavy lyrics, it'll stick with you for a while, whereas if you're working with somebody else, you can sort of clock out almost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, I have never worked with a musician that hasn't taught me something. You know, everybody comes at songwriting from a different motivation. Yeah, it's just a way of furthering exploring music, which I love to do.
Are there artists or out there that you've written songs with that people mightn't know?
That people might not know.
They might not know that you wrote songs for X or Y or Z.
I wrote the lyrics for three songs on the Massive Attack album, Heligoland.
Wow.
And I sang one of them.
Uh-huh.
And Martina Topley-Bird sang another one of mine on that album. And that's extraordinary. I've loved her voice for years. So that's probably actually what got me into the idea. The idea of writing words for somebody else to sing is a real thrill. And I've done string arrangements for the Arctic Monkeys and I Am Clute.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm. I like to keep my hand in. I like to explore.
Wow. But like, I mean, we could talk about other people all day, but like this is this is like when people are downloading this, it has your name like right up there, like just like Brixton Academy down the road.
Mm-hmm.
It just says Guy Garvey up in lights. So at the start of every podcast, we play a very early demo. As early as we can get. Some artists can be very guarded with what they give us, and some can throw out something warts and all. What are we sort of getting from you today on this episode?
Well, I thought what might be interesting, what might be interesting for people who know Elbow's music is an early version of a song from the first album. Three of the songs that made the first album were written a long time before it was released. To very briefly go over our history, we were called Soft. We were called Mr. Soft, then we were called Soft. And in the time that we were learning to play our instruments, the music went from crazy, sped up sort of funk to the sort of thing we're known for now, mm-hmm. sort of balladeering and anthemeering. And the songs that made us realise we needed to change the name of the band, because all the record companies in the land had been getting demos from Soft for a long time,
yeah.
and would have assumed they knew what the music sounded like and chucked them straight in the bin.
Uh-huh.
And we realised if we wanted to be listened to afresh, we needed to pretend we were a different band. So we very hurriedly came up with the terrible name Elbow. But these songs were written just before that, so really these are Soft songs, technically speaking.
Wow. Okay. Right. Let's whack it on.
So this is Powder Blue, and this song got us our first record deal. We decided once we changed the name of the band and we'd written enough material for a show, we decided that it was the last dance for the band. We said if nothing happens off the back of this, we'll call it a day and get on with our lives, because all of our friends had already gone to university and we're getting mm-hmm. on with their lives. We decided to make an EP. So we forgot the idea of labels and we just said, let's make something to keep for us forever. And we made the Noisebox EP. There were 50 pressed in my manager's office.
Wow. Like, I mean, I'd say they're pretty rare right now.
Yeah, they're CDRs. I don't know if any
of
them
quid.
Work anymore. And they were numbered 1 to 50 as well. Mm-hmm. And we sold them at that gig and at Piccadilly Records on Oldham Street. And on there was the three songs that made the album were Newborn, Red, and this song, Powder Blue. So this is the Noisebox EP version of Powder Blue.
Powder Blue.
I'll tell you what, that's one way to end a song there, isn't it?
Yeah. Wild. The memories come flooding back.
Yeah, I was kind of like we were listening to it, like they didn't say a word to each other, but you must have been lost in concentration or like lost in nostalgia, really.
Yeah. And I haven't listened to that song in any version for so long, like for a couple of years at least, maybe a lot longer than that.
Hmm.
Because we don't play it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely lost in it. And listening to it now, it's quite audacious for a
big idea, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like normally with a band at the beginning, it's quite scratchy and raw, but because you had a couple of years in Soft and Mr. Soft before that, you kind of had worked a lot of the kinks out, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and it's also the arrangement I was really proud of them. I remember exactly how it was written. The reason the drum beat's so simple and the bass is so simple is because Craig, who's our producer these days and the keyboard player in the band, sent the music over fully formed in terms of drums, bass and piano, and he was using all the effects off his keyboard that he had to hand.
Mm-hmm.
So they were pretty bad drum samples, pretty bad bass sample, and then his piano, that sort of very, very intense, you know, referring, rolling arpeggio.
Yeah.
And I was very fond of the megaphone effect because...
It sounds great.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, it's one of the things I notice when I'm listening to new music from artists, young bands, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You'll quite often... My biggest complaint normally is that the vocals are mixed too low. Or with singer-songwriters, that they've double-tracked the vocals, you know, meaning they've recorded their voice twice. And what that does is, or they put that megaphonic effect on that I have there.
Mm-hmm.
All these things are disguising your voice. They're all hiding your voice because you're young and you haven't got the confidence to have it as it is.
Is that why you did it there?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And also production-wise, if you squash your voice in that way, you can still hear every word, but it gives the rest of the music more size,
mm-hmm,
because you're much thinner than a piano or a bass sound, so your vocal doesn't get in the way of, you want the music to sound grand. That's a good way of doing it.
What year was that recorded? Like, what? And obviously it's a very, very early era.
I think the song was written at the end of 96. That particular recording was made in 97.
So it's bang in the middle of Britpop, almost like towards the end of it.
Absolutely. And that isn't actually the demo. The demo recording, which is lost, was done in Craig's house, and I put the vocals on through singing through a set of headphones, which is how I got my megaphonic effect.
That's how like the early grime MCs used to do it. They used to sing, they used to sort of like do all their bars and all the rapping through the side of a headphone. I like that.
Yeah. And I think that's what I'd done. And I was so proud of it once it had the backing vocals on it and stuff. I really wanted it to be finished, because what originally happened was, we've always worked like that, separately, sending each other vibes and putting things on each other's recordings. And in those days, it was a four-track Yamaha cassette studio thing. But I was so proud of the song, I wanted to give it an ending, because Craig just tailed off into comedy jazz to make me laugh.
Yeah.
So I smashed a bottle in my bin in my kitchen originally, mm-hmm, to give it that ending. And somebody pointed when it came out that it happens at the end of an Edith Piaf tune, perhaps the most famous one.
Yeah.
Je ne regrette rien. She smashes a wine glass, but I think it was a Lucozade bottle in my case. And then we made the EP with a guy called Steve Lloyd, who had a studio in Prestwich Village. And Steve Lloyd was a very, very beloved man. He died a few years ago, tragically. But Steve was a wonderful fella. He ran all the PAs in Manchester. So he installed all the sound systems in Manchester, and he had a lockup where PA equipment was fixed and stored. And he ran bands around in his vans, and he had loads of crew.
Yeah.
And he had this little studio called Noise Box in Prestwich, and we called it the Noise Box EP because Lloydie was really doing us a favour. I think the whole thing costs... I can't even remember, 50 quid or something.
Yeah.
Minimal anyway. And he was such a hard-working man. And he was one of these guys that's impossible to pay. He just would,
he just won't take it off you.
He just would forget to invoice. You know, and my manager, Phil, who's still our manager to this day, would have to badger him and badger him to be paid. Everybody did, because Lloydie wasn't doing it for the money, basically.
He just wanted the great stuff to come out of his studio.
He did. And he wanted to provide music for all of inner city Manchester. And he worked too hard. He worked way too hard. And during these sessions, he'd come into the noise box, you know. We'd already be in there because he let us have some keys. We'd be in there ready to go. And he said, right, let's listen to where we left it. And he'd put the thing on and he would fall asleep instantly at the desk. And we were so young, we didn't know what to do. So I remember me and Craig looking at each other like, what do we do? So we made him a coffee and we bought him a Mars bar. And more than once, we had to abandon the session because he needed to sleep.
So he literally did work too hard.
Yes. And then adorable. And the kind of man my manager is that perhaps his colleagues these days wouldn't appreciate was when we sold 50 copies of the Noise Box EP, when we sold all of them, he put a gold CDR in a little frame and he made Steve Lloyd, on 50 sales of the Noise Box EP, he made him a framed gold disc.
That's amazing.
Which is very sweet. I'd love to know where that is.
I was going to say, does that still exist?
It must do. It will be among Steve's things, I'm guessing.
So arguably, that track is the one that was make or break, really, wasn't it?
It got us our first deal, yeah. Mm. Nick Angel, who's still our great friend to this day. He's known more now as a music supervisor. Mm-hmm. He's perhaps the leading music supervisor in this country, at least. Nick signed us to Island Records, which was just before it was bought by Universal. And in fact, it was in the purchasing of Universal that we lost our deal before the album came out.
In my research of this, because I've got a potted history of the band because I've been a fan for a while, and I've got the records and bits and pieces. But I went away and sort of like did a little bit of reading beforehand. And yeah, I noticed that you got dropped before your debut album even came out.
Yeah.
Not due to the fact of like they didn't like the music or anything, just victims of circumstance. You must have thought that was the end of it then.
It was tempting.
You must have like thought, right, well, Jesus, like we've got no luck.
it did feel that. I mean, the worst thing was that in the initial negotiations, they said we could keep the recordings.
Which is rare for them.
It wasn't true.
Yeah.
So we remade the record with Ben Hillier. Mm. And luckily for us, Steve Osborne and Ben Hillier were on 140dB management. I think they still are. And because they were spars, the producers from the same stable, any trickiness we could iron out with a phone call, you know. Mm-hmm. How did you get that sound, etc.? And Ben brought something to it, and we got to make our first album twice is the way it feels now. At the time, we were ready to move on writing-wise. It'd been 3 years in the case of this song before it came out. More, in fact. It came out in 2001.
Have you ever, when the second one came out, did you ever think, maybe, the first one's better? Or the second one's better?
The second one was really difficult to make, so at the time I had no perspective.
When
do you mean the second version of the album?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right, no, the second one was definitely better.
Yeah. Well, because, classic case in point, they're staying in Manchester. Not many people have ever heard the Stone Roses Garage Flyer, which was the debut album, really. Mm. But it was mixed and recorded, and it was just horrible. It just didn't sound the way that the debut did. Then they went and did it with a different producer, and obviously one of the most famous debut albums of all time.
Well, there's something that happens right at the beginning of a band's career, success-wise. Mm-hmm. If you watch the Oasis documentary, is it called Supersonic?
Yes, that's amazing as well.
Yeah, and if you hear how those songs sounded just before they were recorded, you know, same guitarists, same words, same melodies, all the same players, and they were awful.
Isn't it crazy how much production can change things?
Well, it wasn't just the production. There's an energy, there's a savagery, and there's also the thing that's often overlooked with Oasis, particularly that first record, is the optimism in the lyrics. It says, you and me are going to live forever. It says, I'm feeling supersonic. Tonight I'm a rock and roll star. It's so optimistic. It's so huge. My friend Steve Manford is a filmmaker and a photographer from Manchester. And he remembers photographing Oasis before anyone had heard of them. And they were walking around Manchester taking photographs. And he said Liam was stopping people in the street and saying, mate, we're in Oasis. We're going to be the biggest band in the world. And
it's pure belief.
You'll remember seeing us. And if people gave him any shit for it, he'd offer him a fine.
Not much has changed, has it?
No. But yeah, as well as that swagger, I remember the first time I saw those boys, it was just such a tonic, that swagger, that arrogance. It was brilliant. And the fact that we're from round our way, it gave everybody a kick up the arse.
I was going to say, what was that like? Because like you, obviously, your band was going around the same time as they were starting. Like, what was it like seeing something like that kick off?
Well, it was great. I mean, even more key for us was when the Stone Roses had been in exile for 7 years. Nobody knew where they were. There was the occasional, story on NME that they've been spotted or something.
Yeah, there'd be like a rumor that like Ian Brown was in like doing kung fu in Japan, yeah. Or yeah. Like Rennie was like living in a like whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they turned up in Bury, our hometown.
Yeah.
They were working at Square One Studios on the Second Coming. And Mark was a pizza delivery boy. The guitarist in Elbow, Mark, was a pizza boy. And he came to the studio one day and said, I delivered a pizza to the Stone Roses last night. And of course we were like, no, you didn't.
No, you didn't.
Yeah.
Shut up, Mark.
So Pete went to work with him the next night. And Pete and Mark delivered another pizza to the Stone Roses, and Pete verified the claim. And then a bunch of our friends saw him in the city centre, in the town centre of Bury. Do you remember that film Whistle Down the Wind?
No, I don't.
So Hayley Mills, it's filmed around Lancashire in the 50s. It's a beautiful film. And Alan, can't remember his last name, he's an escaped convict hiding in a barn, and a little girl discovers him and thinks it's Jesus because he's got a beard. And so he goes along with it because he's wounded. And basically all the local children know that Jesus is in the barn, and they've got to protect him. And, of course, at the end he's led away by the police in a Christ pose. It's a really beautiful
film. Wow, it sounds great, yeah.
But it kind of, the Stone Roses in your hometown when you were already in a band, and nobody told the press, nobody rang the NME, you know. All the bands in Bury knew where the Stone Roses were and just kept a lid on it.
That's amazing. And it goes so well with the biblical imagery that the Stone Roses have perpetuated from the very beginning.
Yeah,
as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
That must have been crazy. But, like, I mean, it's such a fraught of time for you to come up in, like, the greater Manchester area. You know, because, yeah. I mean, the late 80s and 90s belonged to Manchester, yeah. Really, didn't it? But then you don't sound like any of the rest of them.
No, I mean, you
forge your own sonic path, really.
Well, I think it's because it's really collaborative. There's not two of us writing. Mm. There was five, now there's four, you know. And it's like, it's coming from all those different places. And also, we couldn't play, when we got together, a note. We could play 12-bar blues, that was it. But I remember the first time we stopped a song at the same time, and I could hear it echoing around St. Anne's Church Hall in Tottington. Mm-hmm. The fact that we'd stopped at the precise same moment, I thought, this is amazing. You know what I mean? We are one. We are together. And that, I'm still chasing that. I'm still...
Can you remember that first practice that you guys had? Yeah. What was that like? Did you... Because obviously, you say you couldn't play anything.
Like, I'd only just met... I knew Mark from Sixth Form College, but not very well. Mm. I'd met Pete Turner in the pub at the end of the previous term of college. So I met Jupp and Craig on the same day. So I was with a bunch of people I didn't know, posturing that I did know. I think I remember saying, we'll be signed in 6 months. And I was only 10 years out.
Hey, it still happened, though. What did you play at that first practice? Like, did you do cover songs?
Riding Along in My Automobile, Long Tall Sally, and the beginning of Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds. But we only knew the beginning. The intro. I got to tell that to Jim Kerr. I ran into him in his studio, and me and Pete went to say hello and told him that story. That was nice.
Yeah, that's definitely a moment. That's a full circle moment, isn't it?
Well, down the years, I've met the Stone Roses. I've met all of them apart from John Squire, actually. And yeah, telling your heroes how much they meant to you, it's great. And I remember when we got the first EP away, this Noise Box EP, and there was a bit of local noise about the band. I remember Manny coming into the Night and Day Cafe where we based ourselves most of the time.
Which was more of a pub than a cafe, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was a bar and venue, still is.
Still is, yeah.
Yeah. And he made a great public spectacle of bowing deeply in a kind of we are not worthy way to Pete, our bass player.
Oh my God, what do you do? Your ego goes through the roof.
Well, I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it was, there was a lot of bands around at the time and we weren't the cool one, you know. We weren't part of the cool clique. We weren't allowed onto Twisted Nerve, for instance.
Did you have that politics? I mean, I played in bands for years, and like in any scene or city, there's the bands that stick together, the bands that like each other, and then there's the other ones going, oh, why are they doing so good? They're shite.
Yeah, no, we were friends with I Am Clute, Badly Drawn Boy, Doves, you know. Doves took us on our first UK tour and our first US tour. Badly and the Doves boys talked us up massively in the national press. And that kind of lip service to the guys coming after you means an awful lot.
You have
lot.
To do that. And it's something you've done quite a lot as well. Like you do it weekly on your radio show, really, is like, bring through the next group. Because if somebody's been good enough to do it to you, you should be good enough to do it back, right?
Yeah. And also, it's a two-way street. If you spot something great that people are going to love, it makes you look cool to point out. You know, it's like I spotted Fontaine's DC very, very early on.
Uh-huh.
And then they came over and said hello and told us they were fans, which was amazing for us. Very rare that all of Elbow agree on a band. And we all
and it was Fontaine's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then and we played with them in Dublin in the rain.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. And then they came by in just a very sort of brief and respectful doff. And it's good when you're old timers.
They'll not sit and bend your ear for a couple of hours. They'll be in, give you the platitudes and deep, meaningful words.
That's
and then
exactly
they'll,
what
they'll,
happened,
they'll
Phil,
move
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool guys.
Very cool guys. Painfully cool, almost like
just poet warriors, man.
Big time.
Yeah.
What was the moment that like you realized that the band was getting better, that you weren't just doing 12-bar blues and stuff like that?
Well, I didn't finish the thought really when you were talking about the Stone Roses first album being so far away from brilliant compared to the first that everyone accepts as the first. In the same way, before we made these recordings, even a month before we made these recordings, we were abominable. We were terrible. But then something switches. You do an intense body of work, maybe over a couple of weeks, and something switches and you hit something. And then you all hear and feel this thing, which is the best thing about being in a band. The sound is suddenly bigger than the sum of the parts. None of you know which person is responsible for it because you're all responsible for it. And you're playing and you're singing and you're writing to the edges of your ability. And that's the energy that the first Oasis album, the first Stone Roses album has in common. The first Interpol record as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's about it hanging together with spider's threads while being made out of something really, you know, quite precious.
And do you feel that, like when you look back at your debut album, do you think that's the perfect debut album? Or like when you listen to your second album, you're like, oh no, that's where we started really hitting our...
No, I listen to that recording and I can hear some things that make me chuckle in my voice and my delivery.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite singing in my accent. You know, I'm still singing love. I call it my Sunday best voice. Instead of love, I'm singing love. You know, I can hear all my vowels are still sort of... I'm very, very...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Conscious that somebody's listening as opposed to thinking about the song. Mm-hmm. You know, and that long note that I hit at the end of that tune is the reason we don't play anymore. I just can't physically do that anymore. And in that long note, and the fact that we decided to burst ranks in that way and bring those saxophones in, looking back, it's a crazy decision, but it works really well.
Yeah.
And it got me as it was intended to that time. I got goosebumps. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've had goosebumps since we wrote it, you know?
Yeah, it definitely hits you quite hard.
Yeah, and I sort of... that is... I can hear the sound of five old pals... very, very frustrated with the situation and determined that they're going to be heard. That's what I can hear there.
I love that. What was the first show you guys did like?
The first show was Elbow. Hmm. Well, we all remember it very fondly. The year before, we played at Manchester Roadhouse and six people came as Soft. We couldn't even get our family to come and see us. And then we had this period that we're talking about and made changes to the way we thought about writing. And we filled the Roadhouse and got all the local support and sold out the EP. So I've always remembered the gig really fondly, like suddenly we were brilliant. But I listened to the desk tape a few years ago.
Have you still got it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's awful.
Really?
Yeah.
Like just not tight or?
Not tight, not well performed. All of the sounds are crap because we didn't have very good gear. And I don't know what the people in the audience saw, but they had a good time.
Did you come off stage feeling like the second coming?
Yeah, we knew we'd done something. We plugged into something, you know. And I remember Peter Jobson, who's my best friend to this day, the bass player in I Am Clute, very much our sister band in Manchester. Mm-hmm. I remember Pete saying in his warm Geordie tones, "Fucking hell, Garv, that Powder Blue song, there'll be some shagging done to that." Which is the ultimate compliment.
Well, like, I mean, if you didn't write that as a little press caption on the front of your album, then do you know what I mean? Like, you'd have NME going, a thrilling, incredible debut, and then...
There'll be some shagging done to that, Peter Jobson.
Maybe wait for, like, the next big significant, like, date. For that album, and then maybe put it out. I kind of want to talk about like your musical influences, because you've got Irish heritage. Is it your mum or your dad or both, or from
way back both? But yeah, both. On my dad's side, I think 100-odd years before. I think if I'm right in saying this, on my dad's side. Patrick Garvey arrived in Liverpool as a lone infant at some point over 100 years ago.
By himself?
Yeah. Well, like, we don't know if that's... there was somebody waiting to receive him, i.e. family had sent him over, or he was orphan. We don't know.
God, it makes it sound like The Godfather. You know, when the kid arrives over in Ellis Island by himself.
Oh, yeah. At Vito Corleone.
Vito Corleone.
1901.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might not be as sad as we think. It could be that his mother had gone ahead.
You're projecting your narrative like onto, but like, growing up in a sort of family like that, because I always feel, for being an Irish person and being proud of my Irish culture and heritage, I've got an affinity with people from Liverpool and Manchester because they're so heavily populated
yeah.
by people with Irish heritage.
And well, look at the size of my head. There's my Irish roots.
Exactly. Well, that's it's just to keep you going with all the wind. Do you know what I mean? It's to keep you low. It's a load bearing head, like
center of gravity thing.
Did you grow up with Irish music in the house? Did you grow up, what sort of music did you grow up with?
Well, I was brought up a Catholic, so we had, we were part of an Irish Catholic community.
Mm.
You know, so everybody from the woman who delivered me to the priest at the church to most of my mum's friends, I was surrounded by Irish culture growing up. Irish traditional music, not in the house really. My five sisters, we had one hi-fi and it was a small house.
So there was battles?
Yeah. And because I was the first boy, actually, Marcus and I were brought up together as a novelty, you know.
Yeah.
Two boys after five girls. So they would sit and tell you why this was great music. My sister Karen, to this day, is just mad about uplifting, danceable music. She's the biggest Elton John fan in the world. And so you had all that Crocodile Rock thing going on. My sister Sam was a punk. So, you know, grew up with the Stranglers.
I feel like you probably gravitated to that a little bit more, did you?
Well, all of it went in. I loved all of it. And I don't think it would be unusual now to love Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen alongside Genesis, alongside the Stranglers, alongside, you know.
See, I definitely struggled with that when I was maybe about 15 or 16. Because I really, like, you know, the Clash were like the band that changed it all for me, as they have done for every generation since,
yeah.
And will continue to do so.
Mm.
But I really like Queen as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really like all their songs. I like Freddie Mercury more than I like Queen, if you know what I mean.
I love Queen.
Yeah. And I was sitting there like maybe 17, and I'd be like constantly, like, obviously, how easy is life when the biggest problem you've got in the world is, I can't like The Clash and Queen at the same time?
Yeah. This is it.
Identity crisis.
This is it. But I don't think people growing up now have that problem.
No.
You don't have to belong to any faction. And music's music. And actually, it's been the redemption of some artists that were chased out by the cool police, you know. Phil Collins being appreciated by the hip-hop community, you know.
What do you call him? Mike DeMarco's doing all this. Michael McDonald. Like a lot of that soft rock style of stuff.
Yeah.
Has been completely taken over by hip-hop.
Yeah, and it's just people who weren't aware of what you could and couldn't like at the time. I think Queen was seen as soapy and not real rock and a soft option. And actually, when you listen to it, that's some of the most energetic stuff. It's amazing. It's just that it's really refined and really super camp.
Like one of the most popular artists for kids at the minute is an artist called Rex OC, Rex Orange County. He sounds like Randy Newman, and he's like 18.
Yeah, this is great.
You're like, what the fuck?
I think in that respect, there's never been a better time to be making music because you don't have to...
People are open to a lot of different things. You don't have to be tribal.
The other thing is, I always had a problem with trend-setting journalists, you know? It's like one of the major newspapers, I don't want to embarrass this guy, one of the major music newspapers at the time... the first review of the EP that I'm playing you was Easy Listening. And that was it.
That was the
whole review, yeah.
That's very caustic, isn't it?
The other major newspaper gave it a great review, and then John Peel put it in his Festive 50. Oh, God, it was huge.
John Peel being the harbinger of all things cool, putting your thing in his 50 tracks of the year.
I remember exactly what he said the first time he played it as well. Because I listened to it over and over again. We'd never heard our stuff on the radio, and he played that version of Powder Blue. And then he said, that's from Manchester band Elbow. It's coming out on Soft Records. It's called Powder Blue. And in a couple of years, I'll be eligible to wear Powder Blue slacks, which is something I'm looking forward to a great deal. And then he played a Van Morrison tune for Tom, his son Tom, who'd just gone away to start university.
Oh, right.
And he said, this is for our son Tom, who's missing his mum and dad. And he played that Van Morrison. We were born before the wind. He played that straight after.
God,
and then years later, I've been a colleague on Radio 6 of Tom's for... How long? Isn't it lovely the way it comes around? I got to meet his dad once and thank him for putting us in the festive 50. But the guy that wrote the two-word review for the major newspaper and embarrassed us so, I colluded with my manager and we asked him to do the press for the band.
What?
So that he wasn't out there. And he,
so you, instead,
and he, in, so and he took the money and he became our press guy for a little while.
I mean,
wrote our biogs and stuff.
That's insane. That's like keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Yeah,
I think there might.
And I never mentioned to him. We've had some adventures since. He's still my pal, and I've never mentioned to him that that's why I did it. But that's why I did it.
Wow, that is crazy. What with radio, like, was that the best way for you to break back? And somebody who's like obviously been doing radio for as long as you have, do you feel that that was the way that Albo broke? Do you think it was live the way that you broke? Do you think it was the music papers? What do you think that sort of
the kind of music
was the catalyst?
The kind of music we ended up making, which is like Powder Blue, which is this kind of melancholy, exploratory, balladeering, romantic stuff. It has since become popularized and huge, and lots of people rightly point to Coldplay for breaking it and making it an international sound, you know, and their version of it isn't as intricate as Elbow's. Theirs is very much about pop and pop markets, and but they were very, very good to us. They took us on tour and they talked us up, and they're still pals to this day. But yeah, we were part of a certain kind of songwriting, which was about blokes talking about their feelings. It just hadn't happened like that before. Not really.
But like, did you have problems with being so expressive and being from Manchester that time? Do you know?
I mean,
like,
yeah, we were. If you imagine where music was coming from in terms of like everything that Creation Records was doing, which was about rock and roll and about arrogance and about everything that rightly should be part of rock and roll, we were arguably this soft option. And I remember Alan, Creation Records.
McGee.
Alan McGee.
Yeah.
He was quoted in The Enemy of insulting Coldplay and Keane. It was the famous bedwetters thing.
Oh, yeah.
When he coined that phrase. And we were lumped in as part of this insult that Alan McGee had said. And he phoned my manager the following day and he said, I love Elbow and I did not count Elbow in amongst that. And the journalist has added them, you know.
So the journalist has like an axe to grind?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I don't want to get myself in trouble now, but I was talking to a journalist from another country that we're about to visit the other day. And the first guy I spoke to knew our back catalogue and we had a really, really in-depth and interesting conversation about how music's changed in the time we've been making it. And then the next journalist said, critics of your band may say that it's all a bit soft soapy, it's all a bit crybaby, it's all a bit... And if it's not doing that, then it's great big anthems about love, which don't really have any depth. And I was like, sounds like you know these critics quite well. Do you know what I mean?
It sounds like you are one.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I said, you know, I said, I don't apologise for what we do because I know it's coming from an honest place. Whether or not you like it is totally up to you, but I know we accomplished what we meant to do. And also, if you look at the back catalogue in depth, rather than just the big anthems we're known for, there's songs of hate and there's songs of darkness and despair and there's something for everybody in there, you know. But this guy had made his mind up that we were one day like this and nothing else.
But that's it. Like, if you've got somebody, like a journalist who's going in with a predisposed idea of who you are, I mean, you're kind of wasting your time, really, aren't you?
Yeah. And it's one of those things as well. I've seen journalism change in the time.
Well, music journalism barely exists now, really.
Yeah,
there by the skin of its teeth.
In order to keep your head above the parapet as a critic, you've got to be controversial. So rather than being a trusted voice that leads people to records that they will love, you end up being this kind of arch taste maker who occasionally says something they don't believe in order to keep their own image.
But do you think that somewhere like Six Music is really where music journalism has gone now? Like, they don't hire anybody on Six Music that doesn't know their onions.
They don't hire anybody. Well, they don't. It's been the same presenters for how long?
I don't know. You tell me.
They reshuffle them, but
yeah,
it's basically since it was under threat of closure.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's been a single addition.
Amy LeMay,
of course.
There you go.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, I listen to it a lot, so like I
love it. I'm so proud of being
part
of the
majority of the presenters on Six Music are either journalists, ex-journalists, or pop stars.
Well, it was an unusual thing for an active musician to become a radio presenter when I did.
Because you started on XFM, didn't you?
Yeah. I've been doing it for 13 years.
So you would have been doing it with you would have been doing it out of Manchester from XFM back then.
I filled in for Mark Riley when he went on holiday. He asked me as a pal to do his show, and I hashed it up. I very arrogantly turned up with my record box and thought, how hard can it be? And then I really wished I'd done some prep.
Yeah.
I asked him if I could do it again. And then Mike Walsh was setting up XFM Manchester, and he offered me 5 shows a week off the strength of what he heard.
Wow, okay.
And I said, I can't do that many. It can't be bigger than the band, but I'll accept Sunday afternoon. And then eventually I moved 10 till midnight, and I was 10 till midnight on 6 for as long as I could hang on. And then my boss made me move to the afternoon on Sunday. But I love it there.
I mean, like, I've been doing a Sunday show now on Radio 1 for a couple of years. There's a difference between doing a show on a Sunday and doing a show during the middle of the week.
Yeah.
The listenership are much more docile.
Yeah.
And they listen deeper. I feel, because I've done Monday to Thursday, I've done 10 to midnight. I did the old John Peel slot when I started. And you actually, I feel that the people listen to the music a lot more deeper than they do.
It's a lot more personal, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you're not caught in the rat race, I don't feel. Mm. And the live listen is something special. There is a special nature about doing a Sunday. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. My preferred slot was 10 till midnight on a Sunday, because although it was fewer listeners, I knew it would be even more intensely what you're describing. Mm. It would be more personal for those that were listening. And it was for a long time.
Is it difficult to keep the radio going when you've got the band going as well? Because I notice you do take time off where you're just like, right, somebody else will cover. Was Killian Murphy covering you?
Yeah, Killian covers. He's covered me twice now while I've been doing Elbow stuff. I mean, that's partly because I'm busy when I'm touring, but it's also to avoid having two hats on publicly. It's like, I find my radio show is a very personal thing. And it is about the listener recommendations. It's about people telling me what they love in music. And if it gets me, I then project that out again. And everybody's record collections get a bit bigger. I'd say my record collection now is like a...
it's an old 1980s Casio watch going off there.
It's very cool. My record collection's easy. A third of it is listener recommendations over the past 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kept the names with the files in my computer of everybody who's ever recommended a song. So when I play a Red House Painters tune that I heard it for the first time in 2003, I can tell you who recommended it and thank them again. So
I love that.
So the community is just something that keeps refreshing itself.
It's building and building.
Yeah.
Because like, there's so many of you in Albo, like the and you all make music and you're all full-time musicians. Does that mean when one of the other guys in Albo is making music and they know you're on the radio, they'll be like, I'm actually doing a solo project. You have to play this.
I mean, no.
Do you get to that level? Because I do
play stuff they've done. So Craig produced the last C. Duncan record.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I've heard it, yeah.
We only know Chris because I played him on my show and loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took him on the road and we toured together for about a year. And that's where he met Craig. Craig should produce a hip-hop album. Mm-hmm. Anybody who gave him a try there would come away with something very special.
Yeah.
Because that's where his enthusiasm lies. He loves great, big, fat beats. And, he would make a very interesting hip-hop record.
I mean, I want to hear that. There's something I want to get talking about, because I do my research. I found that there was a documentary about your band when you went to play in Cuba.
Mm.
I couldn't find it anywhere, and I really wanted to watch it. And I'm gutted, because I love, like,
the idea. I think there's some snippets on YouTube. Yeah,
I wanted to watch the whole thing, because I'm fascinated by Cuba. I've never been.
Mm.
But what was it like as a band tour in Cuba?
Well, it was very different then. This was like 2002, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Manics had been out there, but nobody else had. We were watched by the Cuban secret police wherever we went, but they were kind of quite bad at it. they were kind of, are we still doing this? It kind of felt, you know, these two guys. Mm-hmm. They tried to steer us round the poverty and the secret police culture, which very much existed there, because like the rest of the Western world, I considered it this free socialist pearl, mm-hmm. this anti-American symbol of socialism working, but it didn't, and it wasn't. It was a very controlled, very controlling place. You're not free to move. You're making it sound
like North Vietnam.
It was exactly like Russia with sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we got talking to some hip-hop artists who are in some of the clips that we that are online, and they were very vocally anti El Presidente, and the following day in front of us they were thrown in a police van.
You're like, geez, take me back to Manchester town.
Yeah, there's nothing free about it. I mean, amazing, this bubble, this period in time. I'm sure that the people they ousted were needed ousting, you know. That's generally the nature of revolution. But what it had become was a dictatorship, you know.
What about the Olympics? When I came to London for the first time, the Olympics was starting. Like, that was the first summer that I started covering people at Radio 1. And I just moved off the dole and was getting paid for the first time. So I was like, wow, this, I mean, like, London Olympics, there's like Radio 1's big weekend was in like Hackney Marshes. Like, I don't know, I just felt like everything was so bright. Like that year. But your song, like, you know, like, it was everywhere throughout the whole Olympics.
Yeah, that was amazing. It was amazing. It's a strange thing. When we wrote One Day Like This, we had no inclination. We knew it'd be popular.
It must be one of the most synced tracks of like that decade, really.
Well, it's
It kind of felt like any.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
Anthemic or, you know, fist bumping scene there was. Like, there that it was there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but to this day, people get married to it.
Mm.
We've been offered obscene amounts of money by advertisers for it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't go there, you know. If we ever do have to go there, like much like the jazz album, you know that I'm skint.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, it's the fact that people walk down the aisle to it is just great. It's like we were so happy to have a record like the Seldom Seen Kid, and we were in such a euphoric state to be back on a record label and about to release an album. And David Joseph, the head of the label, to this day, phoned me up and he said, Guy, this is the best Elbow record that you've made, and we'll sell more records for you than you've ever sold before, and we'll do you proud. But if you have another song that could help us at radio, that'd be great.
That's such a typical record industry thing, isn't it?
Like, but no, he was really gentlemanly, yeah, which isn't typically a record industry. You know?
Very true.
It wasn't a demand. He said, if you tell me this is it, but if you have got one, and I said, well, it's taken 2.5 years
uh-huh.
to write the other 10, so it's unlikely, but I will absolutely give it a shot. And we were so delighted at the time, and I was newly in love as well. And I was living in the centre of Manchester, and things were picking up. And so we wrote this thing, and while we were putting it together, we realised what we had. And it was almost like, this is going to be the most popular song we've ever released. This is going to be really popular. You know, mm-hmm. do you want this to define what we do, given there's so many strands to our work? But we said, but it's great, and it's going to have people singing it from the top, you know, the tops of their voices.
Yeah.
So it's like we allowed ourselves that anthem.
Mm-hmm.
But then it became so big, it rollercoastered us. It doubled our audience. It was the Olympics. It was any other sporting event. And then people started getting married to it. And people, honestly, on a weekly basis, somebody comes up and says, I walk down the aisle to your song, you know, and that's amazing. Yeah. That's a legacy, you know, I never thought we'd have.
Do you have people coming up with a song for all occasions? As in, like, do you hear about people getting buried to, like, elbow songs? Do you have people, like, playing their child the first song they've ever heard? Like,
lots of births,
is there any shocking ones that you're like, going, I lost my virginity to this song?
Yeah, that quite often happens. Yeah, and I mean, there's an awful lot, because we've lost friends down the years, which you do by your mid-40s, and because we've written about that, there's an awful lot of, I listen to this when thinking about my friend, you know, which is just so amazingly flattering. I think because we've written, lyrically I've written about life and I've written about things that have happened, it tends to soundtrack people's lives, you know. There's no right or wrong way to write lyrics, but...
It must give you a great sense of comfort knowing that you're bringing comfort to other people through your music. But sometimes with that brings quite a heavy hat, because... If your music has meant something to somebody, then they want to tell you that. And sometimes those stories can be absolutely harrowing or very hard to deal with. I'm sure you get a lot of people pouring their hearts out to you as well.
Yeah. And it's you know, I'm always willing to listen, because I don't feel that responsibility you're talking about. I did the first time I heard something really heavy, which was, you don't really need it in your head, if I'm honest with you, Phil, but it was something as bad a thing as can happen to somebody had happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And at a ceremony connected to it, they played one of our songs, and I remember it feeling really, really awful. And talking to friends about it, and talking to my mum about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then making some decisions, which was, you can either dilute the honesty and the passion you try and put in your lyrics in order to avoid this feeling of responsibility, or you can learn not to feel responsible.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
There's no choice there, really, is there? It's like, start writing puerile shite that means nothing, or just sounds cool, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
Bands have made careers of it.
Absolutely. But the stuff that resonates most with me, the stuff that I find feeling like a part of myself, is when I feel that it's cost the person who's writing it something, or that they're sharing something really intimate.
Yeah.
So, of course...
Because that's the same way you connect with the artists that you like, do you know?
It's funny, I quite often wonder, when I think about my very favourite music and the stuff that really, really gets me, it's of a certain tempo, it's of a certain mood, it's sapling fresh, it's also quite gentle and fragile, and I think, is that just who I am in the middle?
Yeah,
you know,
there's sometimes with those, like, I mean, the last Nick Cave album is probably the hardest album I've listened to
literally can't get through it.
I was listening to it coming home, because obviously a lot of stuff went on in his life, and if you know Nick Cave, you'll know what that is, without going into it, but I listened to it coming home from work, and I tried to finish it about 4 or 5 times, and I eventually did, but I had to grip my teeth and hold on to the bar on the bus that I was going home on to get through it, because it's so...
Without exaggeration, I've got as far as the end of track 3 about 3 times, and I've just been absolutely awash, you know, absolutely awash, and it's kind of... The conflict is also when you write your life, you know, at a point you think, am I getting songs out of this? Am I getting songs out of this tragedy? You know, and then once you've done it a few times and you realise that you're paying homage to feelings, and that you're, I don't do it as therapy for other people. I do it as an obligation to the boys I write with. And homage to the people I'm writing about, you know. So, friend of ours, the last track on Seldom Seen Kid, we've only performed once, which was with the BBC Concert Orchestra, because it's about the very first friend I lost, Brian Glancy.
Yeah.
And I can't perform it without crying, you know. So we don't.
So play you
it.
Just don't play it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, why would you put yourself through that on stage?
Yeah, and also, we'll never better the performance that we recorded with the BBC Orchestra. It's like, I think it's.
Yeah, you know, once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
So what is the rest of this year hold for you? Are you going out on tour or?
Yeah, we're going to Australia. We're playing all around the UK in April and March. Couple of festivals, and then back to writing another record. I think, yeah.
You do it, and you do, like, it normally takes you, I think I read somewhere, takes you 2 years, I think.
Two and a half.
Mm. So what process are you at right now?
Potts sent me something that he did the other day, and I asked Craig for something quite specific the other day, which he sent me. Mm-hmm. So I've got two little files on the go. I write all the time. I've always got, you know, a means of putting my thoughts down, and I write all the time. And I'm toying with the idea for the first time of putting some poetry together. I've always written poetry alongside songs. And for Christmas, I'm a huge fan of Seamus Heaney. And for Christmas, my wife bought me all of his books in pocket form.
Oh, wow, right.
So he's always with me.
Oh, you've got all Seamy in your pocket there.
Yeah, and he's such a strong character, and he's writing his soul. Mm. Rooted in place and time, but also in his personality. It is like having Seamus in your pocket. and I see his cheeky face, and he's just wise and wonderful and kind. And it's inspired me to put down the stuff that wouldn't make song.
Yeah.
Idiosyncratic details of my childhood that would never make an elbow song. Mm-hmm. It was actually one poem specifically called A Sofa in the 40s. Do you want to hear a bit?
Yeah, go for it.
A Sofa in the 40s. All of us on the sofa in a line, kneeling behind each other, eldest down to youngest, elbows going like pistons, for this was a train. And between the jam wall and the bedroom door, our speed and distance were inestimable. First we shunted, then we whistled, then somebody collected the invisible for tickets and very gravely punched it as carriage after carriage under us moved faster. Chuck-a-chuck, the sofa legs went giddy and the unreachable ones far out on the kitchen floor began to wave. It's just kids playing on a sofa and pretending it's a train, and it's just so beautiful.
That's amazing, yeah, I love that.
It goes on, the poem, and... as you can imagine, far out on the kitchen floor began to wave the unreachable ones. Pretty soon the poem's about looking back on childhood and much bigger themes. Mm-hmm. But it's been spurred by something in his memory. And in that way, you realise the best thing you can write are the details of your past that you perhaps don't think are precious because they've always been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the shade of green of our battered garage door at home. Every other garage door on the housing estate I grew up on was shiny or wooden or automatic, and ours was dented, rusty, battered and green.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, I think, I wonder if there's a few lines in that which puts our family in a place in time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the scruffy kids on the estate.
Yeah.
You know, because there was one wage and seven kids. And sort of, you know, I think it's time to write those little things down.
I want to read that. I really want to read
Thanks, man. Yeah. Because also I've tried to put them in song. There was like, Pot came up with a beautiful little riff. And we wrote a song together that was nearly on the last album. But it was too specific and too sweet and wasn't relating to the rest of the themes on the album, which was pretty heavy, really. It was about our friends dying and my dad dying. It was Grenfell, it was Brexit.
Mm.
And this very sweet song about camping with my family. It didn't really feel, you know, too many kids for the engine was the opening line.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of, you know, too many kids for the engine, mum praying hard for the weather, and the da-da-da when the fly sheet flies, but the frail old seams hold together. It's about the fact that the family tent still works. My sister Gina's got the same tent that she went camping in 60 years ago.
Oh my God.
Because she's kept it greased and dry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's insane. So we can look forward to the Book of Poetry. Hey, Christmas is coming around now in what, like what, 10 months from when we record this? Like, you know that you need to get it out there for Christmas, right? Well,
I think probably what I'll do is write two or three, publish them online, gauge the response, and then if people aren't going, back in your box, Garvey, get to work on another album.
I feel like you'll get a publishing deal now. Somebody will be listening to this. Thank you for inviting me into your studio, and thank you for playing me that wonderful piece of music at the beginning as well.
Thanks for the trip down memory lane, Phil. Lovely to see you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.